Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Everyone, I am Nick Peters, the host of the Deeper Waters podcast. Very glad to have you here with us today. Today we are going to be discussing the New Testament and the topic of, are there forgeries in the New Testament? A question that Bart Ehrman raised about a year or so ago. My guest that is going to be Dr. Andrew Pitts, who I believe is right here on the line. Dr. Pitts, are
yes,
you
sir.
There?
I you am. There? I am here.
Good, yeah. Good.
How are you, Nick?
I'm doing fine. Glad to have you join us. So, my
yeah,
audience,
good to be here.
Yeah, my audience might not be too familiar with you. I understand you've recently got your PhD, and so you're kind of up and coming right now. So, tell us about why my audience should be listening to what you have to say today.
I am. You're quite a fairly new scholar. Finishing off right now my PhD at McMaster in New Testament. And, just published a few articles, one in 2010 and one that is about to be out this year on this topic. The first article dealt a little bit with developments in Pauline eschatology, and that was essentially one of the major focuses in the debate over pseudonymity in the Pauline corpus. Mm-hmm. And then the article I've just worked on deals particularly with the issue of language and style and linguistic shift, or what sociolinguists call style shift, within bodies of writings by the same author. So that becomes particularly relevant to understanding Paul, and did he write all the letters in his name within the New Testament? And so I've got those two articles, and hopefully maybe one day those will become part of a bigger project on this whole issue of Paul and pseudonymity.
Okay. Now, when you talk about style, I've got a friend who's very good with matters of English. In fact, he pretty much proofreads most even major of mine before I send it out there. And he's told me that someone's writing style is practically a fingerprint. And if you recognize the writing style, you can tell if someone wrote it. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, at some level. But what modern linguistics has shown, really, is that kind of style analysis takes a very large body of writings to come up with a sufficient sample. And so while you can detect certain stylistic features within a single author, you have to test the style of writing across several genres, typically, to several different audiences and several different historical circumstances in that person's life. Much more reliable authorship tests are the ones that are constrained by a particular genre, written to the same person in a very short period of time. So maybe, you might be able to discern an author's style if you analyze 10 emails to his wife while he was overseas in China. Mm-hmm. And the reason that kind of contextual information is important is because what modern linguistics has shown is that those contextual factors actually constrain language in a very specific way. And so a letter, or an email rather, to someone's wife is going to look a lot different than even something in the same genre, say another email sent out to a class of my students. Mm-hmm. An email to my wife and an email to a group email to my class of students are going to just use much, much different language. And so the actual style shift between those two writings, although by the same author, will actually be as drastic enough for maybe even some to say, two different people must have written this because we have two different linguistic fingerprints. When in reality, we don't have two different linguistic fingerprints. We have two different situations that are motivating the writing by the same author. And so I think that's a lot of what we find in the Pauline corpus as well. So when we're looking at Paul's writing, we'll notice that, the biggest shift in style, not surprisingly, occurs when Paul begins to shift from addressing groups, his letters to the churches. He wrote 9 letters to the churches, and then he wrote 4 letters to individuals, Philemon, and then the 3 letters commonly called the pastoral, so 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And that, I mean, besides Philemon, which is probably too short to extract any really significant data on style, it's just one short chapter. Besides, you know, removing that letter from consideration, just looking at the pastorals, this is the body of writings that has generated the most discussion and is widely recognized by Bart Ehrman and others to be a Pauline pseudonym or forgery. And the result of style shift between those two writings, if we assume for a second single authorship, if we just assume that Paul wrote all 13 letters, would we and we start from that standpoint and we ask linguistically, would we expect to see a significant shift in language when Paul turns from writing to churches or groups and begins to address individuals? We would expect to see a dramatic shift in language when he's addressing a public audience. And then when he comes to talk really specifically to his disciples and to these pastors that he's mentoring and writing back to and encouraging, there's a level of intimacy that's enhanced there. Some modern studies in sociolinguistics, in fact, Alan Bell has done some really groundbreaking work in field studies looking at the language shift when the only contextual variable that changes is the plurality of addressee. And so he had assessed language variation when a single author was speaking to groups, and the only thing that changed, it was the same subject, basically the same topic matter, and then he assessed when that same author turned to speak to individuals, and he noticed an 80% change in style variables just by changing that one contextual factor. Instead of addressing groups, this person is now addressing individuals on the exact same topic, 80% style variation. And that's actually a lot less than what we find in the Pauline corpus. When we're looking at the letters to the Pauline churches and the shift, most grammatical features noted by, for example, the significant study by Morton that was so popular back in the 60s using computer analysis, that study tends to locate about a 60 to 70% shift in most grammatical features, which is actually less than what we find in modern social studies of the same shift in variable where we have a shift from group to individuals. And so I think that if we assume for a moment that Paul may have written all 13 of those letters and just start from that assumption and ask, which is a good assumption to start from because all the external evidence, with the exception of just a few pieces of evidence, the vast majority, the hundreds of the evidence externally, all the church fathers, for example, attest to the Pauline authorship of the pastorals, with only a few exceptions. And so it's a fair assumption to start from. And we say, hey, should we expect the language to change as we look at the shift from Paul addressing groups to individuals? And as we notice that shift, we should expect a significant degree of change. Modern sociolinguistic analysis says we should, in fact, expect more change than we actually find, which I think is interesting.
Now, I think when you mentioned the computer test, that Dan Wallace has talked about these studies of computer tests and how one of them even showed that the Apostle Paul wrote Revelation 4 and 5, for instance.
I mean, the problem with the computer test, if you look at the journal Computation and Linguistics, there's many, many, many articles in these journals saying, I mean, you usually need a sample corpus of hundreds of thousands of words to even begin to have an adequate sample size to test these findings. And we don't have anywhere near that kind of body of writings for Paul. And so the whole methodology of corpus linguistics, using computer testing to in some way discern Pauline authorship, is actually a misnomer. The modern corpus linguistics studies show very clearly that the corpus sizes we have for Paul the Apostle, especially if you just take the Hofgebrief, Bauer's Hofgebrief, which is just four letters, right? Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Galatians, or if you expand that out to the more modern seven-letter Pauline canon, which tends to include or exclude a number, some of the prison epistles, and usually 1 Thessalonians and Philemon, and then it give or take Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, and or Ephesians. If you take that kind of more restricted body as what we know Paul wrote, then we really, really are limited in the amount of data that we have to extract Pauline style. Then we take into the further consideration that these letters were written at different periods in Paul's life. And so some of them have almost a 20-year gap in the time in which they were composed, something like 1 Thessalonians or Galatians, which on modern scholarly critical scholarship are the earliest of the Pauline letters. I mean, those are could be, on most chronologies, as much as 20 years removed from something like 2 Timothy. And so we definitely have a long period of time. I mean, did your language change at all in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I'd say so. And my viewpoints, in fact, changed on a number of things the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, I mean, the computer tests, I would say that those, I don't even think that those should enter the discussion at a significant level. One of the interesting things with some of these computer tests, the one Morton did was later applied, for example, to a body of writings authored by C.S. Lewis. And they applied the same linguistic methodology. So in 1994, A.Q. Morton, and he did the really famous computer analysis of Paul in the 60s. He applied his methodology to a group of writings that was said to be a forgery of C.S. Lewis called The Dark Tower. Mm-hmm. But later a student was discovered, and he published in 2003 in the Yale Review. He knew Lewis during the time that he wrote The Dark Tower. And so Morton's method showed this work by Lewis, The Dark Tower, to be a forgery. And in 2003, external evidence surfaced that this was not, in fact, a forgery. We had eyewitness testimony to Lewis's actual composition of the work. And so we know these computer tests are not reliable. We know that. And yet it's interesting, Jerome Quinn, in 2008, his Titus commentary, ends up quoting that study by A.Q. Morton, which has been shown to be fallacious. I mean, we know it doesn't work. We've applied it to modern writings that were thought to be forgeries, that later were shown to be by the author that it was ascribed to. And so these studies are highly unreliable, both at a theoretical level, when we look at the corpus sizes that are typically needed to do adequate authorship attribution studies, and at the level of just sheer results. I mean, the methods failed when we have ostensible data that we can compare and say, we know this was written by Lewis, your method says that it wasn't. And so why couldn't that be case with Paul? These are very unreliable studies, and it's concerning, isn't it? To look at the state of Pauline scholarship and to see otherwise very adopting what I believe to be very primitive methodology that bolsters the consensus views of modern scholarship. So I think it's unfortunate. I do hope that my articles and the work of other scholars in this area will help begin to turn the tides a little.
And I do want to make sure, since I'm always one big on clarification, that people know that when I said Paul wrote Revelation 4 and 5, that was sarcasm, joking on my part. Everyone knows Luke wrote those instead. So.
Yeah, no, I definitely picked up on that for sure.
So, Dr. Pitts, what did get you interested in this topic?
Yeah, great question. There's a series of books that my doctoral supervisor edits, Stanley Porter, called the Pauline Study Series with Brill. And so he's been doing that. I've been writing articles for this series since I was a graduate student doing my master's program at McMaster. And each time it came out, it just encouraged me to reflect on the issue that the volume focused on. And so the first one I did was on Paul, Greek, Jew, and Roman. And so I wanted to address some of the shifts. One of the main discussions in this whole debate about, I think the language one is probably the major stumbling block for most critical scholars. They see how different the Greek language is and say, it can't be by the same author. But like I say, that conclusion is fairly naive because it doesn't consider the kinds of sociolinguistic frameworks that provide adequate methodological interpretations for authorship attribution and corpus studies. I think that is the main issue, and so that was my recent article. But I think my first segue into this was when I started thinking about the notion that Paul either changed his mind within his earlier to his later letters, especially on issues of eschatology. And so the argument goes that Paul was, you know, very Jewish in his heritage, and that is reflected, Paul's Jewishness is reflected in his earlier letters, so Galatians, Romans, 1 Corinthians. But as Paul continued the Gentile mission throughout Asia Minor and was exposed to Hellenistic thinking and Greco-Roman ideas, as he became more Hellenized, his thinking, especially as eschatology, developed into a more realized perspective. And so the argument goes, and C.H. Dodd was one of the key proponents of this idea that we have a kind of shift in Paul's thinking over time as he became more and more exposed to Greek culture and Hellenistic theology. He adopts a less futuristic Jewish notion of the end times and moves more toward the Greco-Roman ideal in various realized notions. Now, Dodd thought that Paul just simply changed his mind. Later Pauline scholars, a lot of modern Pauline scholars, say that, well, no, the shift in futurist to realized eschatology is not the result of Paul changing his mind. It's not the result of different theologies in the same author. It's the result of different theologies in different authors. And so this became an argument for many for pseudo-Pauline authorship of the pastorals, and especially where this is relevant, the prison letters. Some of the prison letters are thought to be not written by Paul because of these shifts in eschatology. And so that was I found that to be a very interesting set of issues that I wanted to explore, and so I took the opportunity in Volume 4 of the Pauline Study Series to take a look at some of those issues in more detail. And the first flank of that argument that Paul moved from Jewish to Greco-Roman categories is really based on a historical fallacy. It is widely accepted now within contemporary New Testament scholarship, especially studies in Hellenistic Judaism, due largely to the pioneering work of Martin Hingel, that really we can't make that sharp divide between Jewish and Greek culture in the first century. Martin Hingel coined a very famous term, all Judaism is Hellenistic Judaism in the first century. And so we can't make a hard and fast distinction between these two. So the idea that Paul, as he became slowly exposed to Greco-Roman ideas, the Gentile mission, is based on a false dichotomy and really a highly outdated notion in contemporary biblical scholarship. A second problem with this set of developmental arguments against Paul, and Bart, I mean, these are still around. I've got Bart Ehrman's newest book. He published a more scholarly, like you said, he published Forged last year. And that's a little bit more of a popular level book. It's detailed for being for a lay audience, but it is a more lay level book. He's published this year a more scholarly deepening of some of those ideas in a book called Forgery and Counterforgery, The Use of Literary Deceit in Early Christian Polemics. And so Ehrman has just chapters on this in his newest book, just released this year. And the main reason that's fallacious, in addition to this historical fallacy I mentioned, is that it doesn't take into consideration a phenomena I refer to as rhetorical exigency. And that is really a fancy way of talking about how Paul uses his theology to address specific dimensions of the occasion in the churches to which he writes. In other words, Paul is using his theology as a resource to exhort or to inform in response to very specific situations that are happening in the communities that he addresses. And so really, it's the old fallacy of thinking of Paul's letters as systematic theology or something like that, as though Paul sat down in Romans to write, a theological treatise. He certainly didn't. Or as though, Galatians is, an essay on justification, as Martin Luther kind of seemed to allude. And I just don't think that that's a fair reading of Paul's letters. And it does tend to set the letters in tension if we view them that way, because it implies that they're in some way a kind of systematic treatment of Pauline theological ideas, and they're not. What they are is they're letters. They are letters written to specific communities and are in no way intended to be a systematic expression of Pauline thought. And so we would not expect to find some kind of unified system, because that's just not what they were intended to do. We shouldn't expect that they would be in direct conflict with one another, and I don't think that they are. Instead, we would expect there to be some unresolved tensions, and that's exactly what we find, because Paul is using his theology as a resource. So when he writes to the Corinthians, they have some, in 1 Corinthians, there's obviously a very realized idea that's kind of taken root in the Corinthian community. And so I think Paul, especially in, for example, 1 Corinthians 15, is trying to shift away from that a bit. And so he's responding to these ideas in the community. And so it tends to have a more futuristic connotation. Similarly, in the pastorals, I think his concern is, he's in jail. And so he basically wants to communicate, look, it's not over. We are in Christ. There's a significant dimension in which heaven is now. And scholars have, for a long time, discussed the already-not-yet dynamic of New Testament eschatology. And so I think that plays in considerably here. And so that a shift either of Paul's thinking or a shift in authorship between Paul's earlier letters and his later letters is not necessary once you realize that they are, in fact, letters. They're written to address very specific situations in specific communities. And so they won't always provide a systematic treatment, but will just draw the elements down that they need to address specific, usually ethical issues that have arisen.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be continuing. I've got some more questions to ask Dr. Pitts about forgeries. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
We're back with Dr. Andrew Pitts. We're discussing forgeries in the New Testament. I'm Nick Peters, the host of the Deeper Waters podcast. If you would like to ask Dr. Pitts a question about this, our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Okay, now, another question we have to ask about this is, it's great to know that you're interested in this, you've written on this, But another question the audience might need to know is, why does this question matter?
Yeah, that's a great thing, I think, to ask. Well, it is, as you say, one of the central points that Bart Ehrman is seeking to undermine in terms of the reliability of the New Testament. He clearly thinks that we have these intentional deceptions. And so if he can show through these various historical kinds of arguments, linguistic kinds of arguments, that the later Pauline letters, the pastorals, and others are actually forgeries, they were intentional deceptions, I think thereby he hopes to undermine the validity of the New Testament. Certainly as a document written by God, I mean, you would think that that would call that claim into question, but also I think he just seeks to show by elucidating some of these issues that the New Testament is just simply not a reliable expression of consistent theology within the early church.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, if Ehrman's right, at least, and Ehrman is a radical version of this. One of the things to note here, and he likes to talk in Forged, how the vast majority of scholars accept that the pastorals were not written, by Paul, and that's true. There is some truth to that. Certainly, many, many scholars, although it's interesting, most of the mainstream commentaries, not evangelical commentaries, mainstream commentaries, like Pastorals Volume on 1 Timothy, 1 and 2 Timothy by Luke Timothy Johnson, actually defends Pauline authorship. That's a mainstream commentary. The commentary by Jerome Quinn on Titus does not. But it's interesting to note that the Word Biblical Commentary on the Pastorals by Mounts defends Pauline authorship. The Anchor Bible Commentary as well. We have a pretty strong defense of Pauline authorship there as well. So I find that interesting that a lot of the mainstream commentaries, even though the vast majority of scholars in the New Testament world today would certainly deny the Pauline authorship. What we need to keep in mind with Ehrman's position, though, is it's a little bit overstated, because though many Pauline scholars deny that Paul wrote some of these letters, they don't tend to attribute it to some kind of deceptive forgery. Most Pauline scholars who think that the pastorals were written by someone else think that it was written by a student of Paul, kind of as a later publication of Paul's thinking, or maybe a letter published in Paul's honor. But most scholars who accept kind of a pseudonymity view of some sort don't view it as some kind of malicious or act of forgery, as Ehrman likes to speak of it. Instead, they would think it's kind of like the Gospels, where we have a later publication of Jesus's teaching and deeds. Now, it's different than the Gospel because it is in Paul's name. And while that's not my view, the people that hold that view would hold it a lot of times in a way that it doesn't undermine the integrity of these letters significantly. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as well.
Something we should also keep in mind, considering, is that many ancient documents did not have the author explicitly named in the writing itself, did they?
No, that's true. It depends on the genre. And so a lot of times with letters, of course, you have the author named. But, biographies, for example. I mean, yeah, the Gospels are anonymous. Ehrman likes to go on about that as well. But so are a lot of the biographies, especially if you take them independently. Now, some of them we have in collections, such as Plutarch's biographies or Diognetus. Diogenes. Plutarch and Diognetus' biographies are collections, but the individual biographies themselves do not start out with identification of an author. And so that was a feature of that genre. However, a lot of the letters, for example, that we have in the Egyptian papyri, the collection we find at Oxyrhynchus, for example, those typically do start with an author. And so Well, the documents we find in the New Testament, some of them being anonymous, others having a name attached to them, are what we'd expect to find in the Greco-Roman world within these various genres. It's one of the reasons people think Hebrews is probably not a letter, but some kind of a sermon. In fact, I think that's probably an anachronistic labeling of Hebrews. I don't think there was the literary form of sermon in the first century, as we would think of it at least. But some kind of a speech that was later published is probably what we have with Hebrews. Again, that accounts for why Hebrews is anonymous. So
Ben,
a lot of these documents were anonymous.
Ben Witherington, in his book, What's in the Word, talks about that we lose sight that these texts that we have are really meant to be oral text at the start because most people couldn't read. So these texts would be read aloud to them instead. And if we just look at the written side of the text, we miss out that. And he does include Hebrews as a side, as a text that was meant to be read as if it was a message to an audience.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, in Colossians 4:16, for example, we actually have a command to that effect. Also, see that this letter, the letter to Colossae, and the letter to Laodiceans is read, you know, among you. And so he wants them to have Colossians read in the Laodicean church, and then the letter that was written to the Laodiceans, which was probably Ephesians, that letter was to be read in Colossae. So, yeah, we have this culture of reading. Yeah, the churches would probably receive the letter. Yeah, Ben's right about that. And then it would be read in the community. And so that's true. We do have that kind of phenomenon. And I think some of the studies of literacy in the ancient world may be overstated. There's actually more evidence than I guess we often give the ancients credit for of reading and writing in the ancient world. Nothing like today's literate society, of course. But Catherine Hesser has written a few books now, one in particular addressing literacy in Roman Palestine. And she comes up with some very interesting findings and shows at least a higher literacy rate than is often assumed. William B. Harris is another one. His book, Ancient Literacy, talks about different levels of literacy. And so a lot of people could write a little, read a little, but in terms of scribal literacy, like we would think, or modern literacy, that's actually what was rare. And so I think that's an important consideration taken to the discussion as well.
When we were talking also about the other works not having names, I think one reason we can do that is to show that we're not just saying something in favor of a biblical text, we're showing that this applies to all ancient documents. So you mentioned Plutarch especially, so how do we know Plutarch wrote Plutarch? Because as far as I know, that's not very questioned in the scholarly world.
Oh, no, I mean, Plutarch's not. Like I said, with Plutarch, we do have, you know, I mean, it's not as though, it's not, we don't have the kind of discussion around forgery that we do with Paul in classics. There is some of that, but it's not nearly as pervasive, I guess. Typically, when an author, if we find a document that claims to be written by an author, or most of the times, unless we have strong evidence, really strong evidence, a lot of times external evidence to the contrary, we accept the external testimony. So the kinds of pseudonymity debates that go on in Pauline scholarship, while present in classics at a much lesser level, are not nearly as as intense or pervasive in that field, and that you'll find that in general when you compare ancient history with the kind of history that biblical scholars do. We approach the New Testament documents with a much higher degree of skepticism as New Testament scholars than do classicists with ancient text from the same era. And that probably has a lot to do with the religious communities with which these texts are put to use in. And I think that may be fueling the discussion at some level in ways that are often unhelpful. Mm-hmm. But, we could address the psychology of that, but we know Plutarch wrote, you know, his collected biographies and the various histories that he composed and his works on morality, really in quite the same way we know Paul wrote the 13 letters in his name. Plutarch says he wrote those things. There are some stylistic variations, even within Plutarch's corpus, that we could potentially explore. And I don't think that has been done. I'm looking at researching that as part of a future project. But it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to pick apart some stylistic variables in a corpus of writing such as Plutarch. And we have some letters by Plutarch. We have some biographies by Plutarch. We have different genres. So it'd be interesting to look and maybe assess some differences stylistically within the Plutarchian corpus and see if we don't find some of the same kinds of variations we find between Paul's accepted letters, as they're often called, and, for example, the pastorals. I suspect that we would find many, many similarities in variation if we compared bodies widely acknowledged to be by the same author in classical studies with writings by Paul, often thought to be authored only in Paul's name, but with different authors behind it.
You might want to talk to Mike Lacona about that, who, by the way, for my listeners, is the one who recommended I get Dr. Pitts on here. So that's the kind of backing that Dr. Pitts has, is that Mike Lacona says, hey, this is someone you should listen to. But he's doing a lot of research now on Plutarch's writings and the differences that are found within the writings, and making a comparison to the Gospels that way, and saying, hey, were the ancient biographies allowed to take certain liberties that we would call contradictions, but back then wouldn't? So that could be someone to talk to you about that.
Oh, yeah, and Mike sent me, I've looked over Mike's work on Plutarch and biography. Mm-hmm. Kinds of devices within ancient bios that were, as you say, accepted within the genre, but to the modern eye may seem as tensions or contradictions, the time compression stuff and other issues. I guess he's presenting that at the EPS conference this year. So it's really interesting work that Mike's doing. I have some writing. Actually, it was a byproduct of my dissertation that I've been working on. So I would actually define the Jewish Gospels as biography, but Luke, along with Acts, as a two-volume history. And so I'm not sure where Mike's at on Luke's work, but the vast majority of scholars take Luke as biography as well. That creates a tension, because the vast majority of scholars also think Acts is history. And the vast majority of scholars believe, thirdly, that Luke Acts is a single unified volume. But it seems implausible that they're unified but different genres. So I think the most convincing position is that Luke Acts is history. And the same kinds of things that Mike is finding in assessing biographical writings and comparing those to the Jewish Gospels, I call the Jewish Gospels Matthew, Mark, and John. Those are three Gospels, more than likely written by Jewish men. So I refer to those as the Jewish Gospels, with Luke as a Gospel written by a Gentile. So Luke is writing in ancient historiographical genre, and when we look at the kinds of alterations and changes that Luke might have made to his material, what we're dealing with is what scholars, especially classical scholars, refer to as historical mimesis. And mimesis is basically a Greek word that means imitation, or imitatio in Latin. And it's the whole process of imitating the speech and deeds of one's predecessors. And so this would involve Luke's imitation of the Jesus tradition, his imitation of any literary documents that he had access to, whether they were Gospels or something else, any tradition Luke had access to, the Septuagint, the Old Testament in Greek, which is what he used when he cited Scripture. And so mimesis is the literary mechanism by which tradition enters Luke's narrative or any historical narrative. And as Mike is finding within ancient biography, if you look at Thucydides, Herodotus, Xenophon, any of these ancient historical documents, Appian, Josephus, the whole range of ancient history, Polybius, they're adopting their historical predecessors largely through mimesis, not direct citation. So biography cited their sources a lot. They often drew attention to the sources they were citing. Not so with ancient history. They typically just brought in the prior traditions about their subjects and the events they documented just by straight imitation, without any citation whatsoever. And that's why Luke has upwards 50% less scripture citation than the Jewish Gospels, because Luke is history, the other Gospels are biography. The implication that has for the Gospel contradictions are really, really significant and related in many ways to the work Mike's doing, because as in biography, so also in ancient history, we find a great deal of liberty through this mimetic mechanism. As the historians imitated their predecessors, they would often make subtle changes. For example, they would change the order of events. This wasn't considered some kind of a fabrication of the history. They would change the order for a number of reasons. Number one, for stylistic reasons, just to enhance the tradition. The readers or the hearers, as you were pointing out earlier, this highly oral culture, when a gospel was being read, they would be familiar with the tradition, for example, that we have in Matthew of the temptation of Jesus, okay? So we have the temptation of Jesus, and in Matthew's gospel, the temptation to jump off the temple comes second in the order, whereas in Luke's gospel, Matthew 4 and Luke 4, the temptation comes last. Mm-hmm. Okay, so which tradition is correct? Well, most scholars think that the Matthean tradition is probably the original, and I tend to agree with that position. I mean, certainly we didn't have two temptations, right? So harmonization seems difficult on this particular issue. So we have to say that one was probably prior. The Matthean tradition is probably the original, and so how do we account for Luke placing the temple temptation last? Is Luke fabricating the history? Does he have some kind of ulterior motive that he's trying to convey? Is he trying to deceive his audience? Oh, of course not. This was standard mimetic practice. When you're imitating the tradition, it breathes life into an old tradition to change for a point of emphasis. And actually, we see in Luke's gospel that the temptations are actually an outline of Jesus' ministry. And so the first temptation, we have Jesus in the wilderness being tempted by Satan for bread. And so the first temptation is located in the wilderness where Jesus is. Then Satan takes Jesus and offers him all the kingdoms of the world. And that corresponds really to Luke 4 all the way through Luke 19, Jesus' healing ministry, where and Satan says, "For I have the dominion to give you this. It has been mine to give you the dominion, to give you the kingdoms, to give you a reign over all the kingdoms." And Jesus refuses. And then Luke 4 through 19 becomes a telling of how, though Jesus resisted Satan's temptation, he, through God's power and through the Spirit's power, is able now to take those kingdoms by casting out the demonic. And Luke does have Jesus in Luke 9 sending out the disciples, and he says that, they saw Satan falling from the sky when they healed the sick and when they cast out demons. And so these exorcisms are a way of Jesus taking by God's strength what Satan tempted him to take through an evil way, through a wrong way. And so Luke 4 through 19 corresponds to the second temptation. And then finally we have Jesus in the temple. And it's interesting, Satan quotes David in that last temptation. If you cast yourself off the temple, he will bear you up with angels if you are the Son of God. And so Jesus, in Luke 19, goes into the temple and quotes David again as a kind of a way of saying, hey, I'm taking the temple now. I am going into the temple and overcoming where Satan tempted me to shortcut God's plan and God's providence and God's destiny for him as Messiah. And so we have Luke, probably motivated by the narrative structure of his history, to move that temptation to the last part and to breathe a fresh reading into the temptation narrative. Another thing important to consider is that in these biographical portions of ancient history, they developed from a form called eulogy. And eulogies, a funeral eulogy, for example, they were the listing of great deeds of men. They were not a chronological listing. They would talk about, how Caesar conquered, this land and how, he was a mighty father. You say, wait a minute, he was a father before he conquered that land. You're fabricating the history. No, nobody's fabricating the history about Caesar. We're just not listing his accomplishments in chronological order. And so also in biographical portions of ancient history, you have a listing of activities that are often arranged according to prominence of some sort, or according to the narrative scheme or the narrative flow. They're not always organized chronologically, so that will account for some of the contradictions. In addition to the work Mike's doing with Plutarch, by referencing this phenomena of historical mimesis and how prior traditions were imitated and brought into the narrative, sometimes altering the order, but usually never altering the substantial content. Typically that remained the same. And so we have kind of an external or stylistic level of alteration, but the internal content or the core of the tradition is typically preserved in ancient history, as I believe it is in the gospel.
Okay, we're going to take another station break now. And my call number is 714-242-5180. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Pitts discussing forgeries. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
My call-in number is 714-242-5180. My guest is Dr. Andrew Pitts discussing forgeries in the New Testament. One aspect that hasn't come up with this yet, I'm kind of surprised it hasn't, but I think it's very important, is the concept of secretaries, that there are many letters that are undisputably Pauline, but we know by the admission within the text itself, such as Romans, were written by a secretary. So how does this affect forgeries? Because it's my understanding Ehrman doesn't really interact too much with a secretary hypothesis.
We definitely do have, I think, this whole additional set of considerations with the potential involvement of an amanuensis of some sort. E. Randolph Richards has perhaps done the most sustained treatment of the secretary in the Pauline letters. And so for those of you who are interested in looking at that a little further, I'd recommend his work. He has both his dissertation, which was published in the Voomp series by more feedback, so you can take a look at that. And then he also has a more popular treatment of that came out a little later that is certainly more affordable and probably more readable as well. So I do think this is an issue that's relevant here. I don't think it's necessary to even posit that. We can show on linguistic considerations alone that this is a pretty bad argument. But once you add in the style shift that's resulting from differing secretaries within the Pauline letters, Absolutely, Nick. I think that becomes a really important factor that is going to have an impact on style and makes it all the more complicated to make authorship assessments based on style alone. And that really is, again, the main driving factor. They're saying the style between the letters is different. There is the shifting theology, but the weight of the discussion really leans heavily on issues of style. Now, Ehrman is a little bit more nuanced in this, and he tries to take the emphasis off style in his book on Forged and place it on these theological kinds of considerations, but I think those are probably even weaker. But once you add in the secretary, I think the issue just becomes so difficult to assess that we really just have to lean on the external evidence that we have. And what does the external evidence tell us? What tells us that Paul wrote all 13 letters? So, yeah, that's a good point, Nick. The amanuensis is going to be yet another level of complexity that makes it difficult to overturn Pauline authorship that's so thoroughly attested externally through the church fathers and Paul himself. The author says it's Paul. Our external evidence generally agrees with that. When you've got like P46, for example, I mean, that's probably the most significant piece of evidence against Pauline authorship, because that's the earliest canon or corpus we have of the Pauline letters. It's a second century collection of Paul's letters, and it doesn't include the pastorals. But I think there's a good reason for that. It does include, these letters to the churches. It also doesn't include Philemon. And so I think the reason that it doesn't include those is because there were probably these collections of letters to the churches, of which P46 was one. And then there was maybe a separate collection of letters that was to individuals, so the pastorals and Philemon. And so that's how I deal with that. But, going back to the amanuensis question or the secretary question, I think you're right. It pushes us back to the external evidence. The external evidence is very clear. It makes the style question at best ambiguous. And so I think that's an important factor. It's a good point.
Now, to give a little plug here, since you mentioned E. Randolph Richards, for my listeners in the future, we are working on getting either him or his co-author, Brandon O'Brien, with a book, Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes, to come on the show sometime to talk about that book. So be watching E. Randolph Richards be on here sometime. So, when we're talking about... When we're talking about going to the external evidence, when we get to something like, say, the Gospels, I wish I had a nickel for every time some atheist shows up and says, like, these are anonymous documents that we're testing. Now, even if ancient works like these didn't have names written on them, there would be ways for the immediate recipients to know who the writers were, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah, in terms of the communities of faith that receive these documents. Yeah, it's generally acknowledged that we have the Gospels composed, at the very least, late within the first century. So we tend to have a wide consensus view in scholarship on that point, at least. A few scholars still place Luke late, but the vast majority will place the Gospels, I think, composed somewhere within the first century. And so you have these communities of faith out of which the Gospels were birthed. These were the four documents that were received. There seem to be some very strict criteria on the basis of which these particular documents were received by the earliest Christians. And those criteria seem to be twofold. They tended to be based on at least a tradition linking back to eyewitness testimony or historical autopsy, and then they were written in the generation of the events in which they occurred. And so historical autopsy is a very important feature of ancient historiography. This was taken to be authoritative for the ancient historians. John Marancola has written a really excellent work called Authority and Tradition, and he argues thoroughly, this is a book on ancient historiography, but he argues thoroughly that autopsy was kind of the main way in which the historian garnished authority within its composition. And so, applying that to early Christianity, the culture that had emerged around historical documents, such as the Gospels, was one in which autopsy was a very important feature, ascribing authority to that writing. And so that's one of the reasons the four canonical Gospels were received by the early Christians, is because they were eyewitnesses. They were believed to have this, or they at least were linked to an eyewitness tradition, as we have with Mark and Luke, right? Those documents actually go back, one to Peter and one to probably the Pauline tradition of some sort, and then other strains of Jesus tradition with Luke. But that was an important authoritative feature for them. And then I think derivatively, this first century authorship, right? To have that historical autopsy, they needed to be written in the first century. And so those are the only four documents that we have that have those two features. Literally every other, many of which are also anonymous, every other so-called gospel, that was written and later kind of debated are second century, with the exception, arguably, of the Gospel of Thomas. But I'm not convinced that even Thomas is early. The main basis for making the Gospel of Thomas early is that it's a saying source. We know Q is, along with Mark, the earliest type of Jesus tradition. And so we have Q and Mark as the two earliest streams of tradition, presenting especially Q with Jesus as a teacher. And that was kind of the core around which the narratives of Jesus were built. But that's a very delicate set of arguments, and you kind of have to buy each flank of that scenario to endorse an early date for Thomas. It's not like we have these first century papyri of Thomas. That's not the case at all. Our documents of Thomas are not incredibly early, and so really we just do have, in terms of first century documents, the four canonical Gospels, and that is because those are the only four documents that had a historical autopsy and were received as such by the early Christian community. So it doesn't matter. I mean, the authorship, even if we accept that these are anonymous documents, we do not know the author, that the four first century documents were accepted, that is, the four that were written within a generation of Jesus' life and teachings, that those four were accepted by the earliest Christians, aside from all the external evidence that we do know the authors of those documents, that in and of itself testifies to the historical autopsy of these particular Gospels and the tracing of these documents really closely back to an eyewitness tradition.
Okay, we're going to take this break here a little bit early and come back. I've got some more questions to ask about specific claims of forgery in the New Testament. My guest is Dr. Andrew Pitts. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. My guest is Dr. Andrew Pitts. I am Nick Peters, a host of a Deeper Waters podcast. Our call number is 714-242-5180. So let's return to the Pauline epistles and such, because we can say the Gospels are anonymous. We can't really say they're forgery since they don't claim authorship, but Pauline
of
epistles.
Of course not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Yeah, this is all that we can say, based on the fact that they're anonymous, is that they are writing in accord with the literary conventions of the genre in which they were composed. That's it. We have histories that just start straight away into the history without a direct identification of the author. We have biographies that do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and as you say, the forgery question isn't even an issue at that level because they don't claim authorship. So, but I don't think that they are anonymous is a big issue. And a good place to look on this question of the Gospels before we move on is Martin Hingle. He wrote an excellent book on the four Gospels where he talks about the early attachment of these inscriptions, in our very, very earliest manuscripts. And so these were attached very, very early, and they are in many of our Greek manuscripts. And so it's not a tradition that was, say, added, later in the process. These were attached to our earliest biblical manuscripts very early in the process. So they likely preserve an authentic tradition about authorship.
Now, to get to the Epistles, when I was reading Forged, something I noticed about Ehrman's arguments was I found them incredibly weak on a number of points. For instance, in 2 Thessalonians, he talks about how Paul writes that we have a person who claims to be right, but we should say at this point writes, to be on guard against forgery because of a letter that had been claimed to be in his name. And my thinking on this topic has been, and I mean, I could be wrong, but it's still a plausible hypothesis that would explain that the letter they were set up that they didn't understand was in fact 1 Thessalonians itself. And Ehrman has this note in here that says, see, the reason that that the writer puts this in there is to make it look authentic. And I look at that and I think, but real writers put those notes in there just as much. So that note is in there isn't enough of an argument to say, therefore, this is a forgery.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a very circumstantial piece of evidence. I think that the cases at best ones I accept Pauline authorship. As I said before, I don't think that, and you make a good point, Nick. That hardly is able to bolster the thesis that Ehrman wants it to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think someone could be, there are conservatives, for example, Robert Stein, a fairly conservative scholar denies the authorship, the Petrine authorship of 2 Peter. There are a lot of conservative scholars, evangelicals, that deny the authorship of 2 Peter. They don't think that it's some kind of a deception or forgery, and I'm not so sure that that's inconsistent with a high view of Scripture. And so I think you could theoretically hold these views in a way that is potentially consistent with a high view of Scripture. So my insistence on upholding Pauline authorship for these letters is in no way rooted in a conservative impulse as much as it is in the evidence. I mean, the evidence for Pauline authorship is just overwhelming, based first on the external attestation and then the highly questionable linguistic assumptions that are used to overturn external evidence through internal considerations such as change in vocabulary, change in style, shift in theology. Those are some of them so linguistically naive and so out of step with modern sociolinguistic studies of authorship attribution that I just find the case against Pauline authorship to be highly unconvincing. And that's why I continue to uphold the authorship for all 13 letters. And so Ehrman's evidence is nothing new. He leans heavily on these kinds of theological considerations and tries to create a, as it, this instance in 2 Thessalonians you mentioned is indicative of a larger set of arguments that he tries to make. Well, there was this context for forgeries in the ancient world, and forgeries were happening all the time. And okay, I grant that there certainly were forgeries, and this was a phenomenon that was taking place. Granted, but what is the evidence that that happened in the case of Paul? I think we actually turn to consider Paul's evidence. The considerations in favor of that theory are just very, very weak. They tend to lean too heavily on style. The theology considerations are based on outdated assumptions about first century Judaism and don't take into consideration the occasional or rhetorical situation of Paul's letters. And so, yeah, the arguments so far are just incredibly unconvincing.
Yeah, we've had Tim McGrew on here, I believe it was last month, and he's talked about Ehrman a good deal, and with the idea on some of us here, but Bart Ehrman has some of the best arguments of the 19th century that you can find.
Yeah. It's older scholarship kind of rehashed and updated it, and in some ways even more critical than his Enlightenment predecessors.
When you talk about style and the way they write, one idea I'm remembering is that N.T. Wright has critiqued people who say that Paul never talks about justification in some of these other letters where he says, reading these people, you'd think that if Paul wrote out a grocery list, he'd have to include justification on there for the list to be by him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of this set of theological issues that are often raised, and they say, okay, well, how do we, what was Bauer's reason for saying that, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, and Romans, those are Pauline? Well, they all address justification and the Jew-Gentile controversy. They're all on the same topic, therefore by the same author. And how naive is it to assume that a single author, especially someone as intellectually capable and as innovative as Paul, he couldn't address different topics in the letters he wrote to different communities. And again, I think the whole fallacy here lies in the assumption that Paul's writing systematic theology. Once we deal with that assumption and say Paul is not writing systematic theology, he's writing epistles, letters. What are the function of those letters? They're to address very specific issues that are cropping up within these ancient church communities that he addresses these letters to. And so Galatians, that community was struggling with issues of justification. Yes, in Rome, we probably have a divided church, and justification was that issue because it covered the broad sweep of Gentiles and Jews. We had a Gentile and a Jewish church probably divided in Rome after Claudius's Egypt edict, and the Jews were turning back to Rome where the Gentiles had now taken over. Justification becomes kind of a broad brush theological concept that can bring unity to that divided community. And so, yes, in Romans we have issues of justification. That just wasn't the case in Philippians. We have a totally different set of issues in the letter Paul writes to the church at Philippi, and therefore Paul draws down different theological resources and says, we have different theology here. No, we have a different set of circumstances that Paul is addressing from the same theological structure, and it wasn't necessary in those earlier letters to draw down the same points of theology in response to the issues that had arisen in those churches. And so, again, it just seems like a highly, highly simplistic argument that assumes, Paul can only address a very circumscribed set of topics and issues in his letters. It's a very artificial criterion, in my opinion.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a kind of parallel here for modern times. I've mentioned Mike Lacona, and he'd agree with me on this. He's like, Gary Habermas is the world's leading authority on the resurrection today. And listeners of the show might know that Gary Habermas is also the one that introduced me to my wife. And so from time to time, I'd email him, and he'd email me, and we'd discuss back and forth how things were going, and he was the guy who also married us, so we had to make email arrangements about when it's going to be, what church it's going to be at. And believe it or not, in some of those emails, I'm quite sure we never once mentioned the resurrection. So if we're going to use this kind of criteria, I could just as well say, well, obviously someone else was emailing me the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good point, Nick. It's just a criterion that would never, yield authorship distinctions if we applied them to corpuses of writings that we knew were by the same author, even the same person a lot of times. And so I think you're quite right about that. I've got an idea that I hope to pursue at some point. I wonder if we took, I attempted doing this for my article, but it turned out to be a more involved procedure than I had originally hoped it would be. But I wonder if we took all of Bart Ehrman's writings in different genres. You know, and he has a few different books. You know, he has his Jesus, books, on Jesus Interrupted, for example, where he kind of deals with gospel contradictions. And we took something like that, a popular level genre, where he's writing to a popular audience, and compared that to some of his more technical works on text criticism. We're going to find a totally different set of vocabulary. Right? We're going to find a technical register. He's going to be using terms that his lay audience, which he addresses in Jesus Interrupted. Now, I bet if we tested those two kinds of sets of just Bart Ehrman's popular writings, you know, his book on God and Evil, Jesus Interrupted, these kinds of writings, to his technical scholarly writings, we could find that there are actually two Barts, right? And we could accuse Bart Ehrman of forgery, right, on the basis of some of these very criteria that he uses.
We won't know, though, until we do computer tests.
Yeah, well, that's what we were working on. I have a colleague that works in computational linguistics. Actually, we've collected primitive data sets already that yield different authors for Bart Ehrman. So we've done the computer tests already. So tentatively, it looks as though we can show, based on corpus analysis of vocabulary, mainly vocabulary and sentence length, are the two variables we're looking at in Bart's writings. We can show different authors for these two sets of words by Bart Ehrman, ironically.
I have done some teaching on these kinds of topics before, and one thing I like to give when I'm telling people about the problems of Bart Ehrman and textual criticism, as I say, and I'd like to give you another quote by a textual critic who's a scholar in the field also, who says, at one point in the book, in spite of these remarkable differences, scholars are convinced that we can reconstruct the original words of the New Testament with reasonable, although probably not 100% accuracy. The first step in doing so is to characterize the kinds of changes that scribes made in their text. So, I mean, this is a scholar saying that we've got the New Testament down with reasonable accuracy. We can be sure of that. And I'm sure you know which scholar I'm talking about, don't you?
I think that reflects a consensus in New Testament scholarship. Obviously Dan Wallace would be a big advocate for that kind of thinking, but also Bart Ehrman's own doctoral supervisor and mentor, the late Bruce Metzger, have made statements to that effect. I think Metzger said, we can reconstruct the New Testament with 99.5% certainty, and then that 0.5% variation is really a set of incidental details within the New Testament text. And so, I think that Bart is on the fringe in terms of his views of textual scholarship, at least as they're expressed in his, books on the corruption of the New Testament. Misquoting Jesus is the main one I'm thinking of. His academic works are much more nuanced and careful, but where he can get away with it is in the popular press, where he kind of has these broad, unclarified, unqualified statements that I believe are quite misleading.
Well, actually, Dr. Pitts, I find it also very interesting because this caller I had just quoted on this, it wasn't Bruce Metzger, and it wasn't Dan Wallace, it was Bart Ehrman himself. In a more academic writing, his Introduction to the New Testament, his third edition. So Dan Wallace is what that's out. When Bart writes on the academic level, he's very, very positive. When he writes on a popular level, he's very, very negative.
That's true. Yeah. As I said, he seems in his scholarly writing to be kind of nuanced and qualified in his language, but when he comes to the part, I think Dan's quite right on that. You know, and I haven't read a ton of Dan Wallace's response to Bart, but sure, I think that's a great insight that now that you say that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and it's so great to be teaching a class and have them just get a stunned look on their faces and you bring that out or quote someone and say, I'd like to show you what another textual scholar has said about, oh wait, this is Bart Ehrman actually, because we could use the same criteria he uses in Forge and ask, well, these are two really different opinions, because this writer doubts the New Testament text is accurate, this writer affirms that it's reasonably accurate. Which one wrote which?
Sure, and it kind of pushes back to the whole, did Bart changing his theology, or are there different theologies, are there different authors? And it kind of does speak to that issue of register and context and who he's addressing and how language changes, and apparently, I mean, there's probably some way Bart is holding these views in tension, but I think Bart knows that the text is, as he says, something that we can reasonably reconstruct at a pretty high level of accuracy, even if not a perfect 100%. And the way he writes at the popular level the best way I can put it is un-nuanced. He just kind of makes these blanket statements, which have some truth to them, but without qualification, are taken to be understood in a way that really is misleading.
Another criticism along those lines is when I read Forged and Misquoting Jesus and other books, there's not really much interaction with the other side. I mean, if you read Forged, you don't get, here's why some people believe these books are authentic. You just get one side of a story.
Sure, yeah, and I think that's kind of part of his style and his argument is he's really, you're right, just kind of, this is the only show in town kind of idea. And that is especially disturbing when he will make a statement about the state of scholars. Well, all scholars agree that we have all of these variations, but then he won't give kind of the clarifications that, undergird some of those conclusions and make them, I guess, more feasible in terms, of how we fit those considerations with all the variability into a broader picture of textual criticism. Instead, it's just kind of these unqualified blanket statements about what scholarship believes, which, in some cases will be true. Scholars do widely recognize, that there are tons and tons of variation within the New Testament. But they also believe, which he doesn't state, that these variations don't hinder but actually help us recover the text of the New Testament. And so it's that kind of an argument that he likes to lean on in his popular level writing that I think can be confusing to the person that's not trained in biblical scholarship. One of the main fallacies that I pointed out in a book that is now written on textual criticism, it'll be coming out hopefully next year. We're using it in the classroom right now. The main fallacy, as I've found, and I don't think anybody else has pointed this out, there's been a popular level response to Bart Ehrman. It was a book length treatment, not the one by Wallace. I won't mention the author's name. I think Wallace's edited volume is probably the best response in print to Ehrman. But there was another single author book that came out a bit before that that was, I think, a very poor response to Ehrman. And this author attempted to grapple with some of the stuff. And I just don't think he had the training to really engage a st- scholar of Ehrman's caliber. So my doctoral supervisor and I wrote a book on text criticism, and we kind of worked in some response to Ehrman within the narrative of this text criticism intro for seminary students. And the fallacy we observed in Ehrman's misquoting Jesus is basically a tendency to take a text-critical problem that could be easily solved by the canons of textual scholarship. So, and I'll speak in popular language here, sometimes, and this is a very common cause for variation, sometimes an author will see a letter on the line above, and it'll have the same letter as a word two lines below, and so they'll skip a line. And that's the cause for numerous variants. It's a typical scribal variant. And so a lot of the variants that Ehrman points out that he calls textual corruptions or theologically motivated changes can easily be solved by the standard canons of textual criticism. And those are errors like that. They're unintentional errors. And so you would have two levels of errors that are introduced in the New Testament text. Unintentional errors, and those are by far the more common. And then you have very, 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 less common set of errors, and that is those that were intentionally introduced. You have those, the theologically motivated changes, but they are far, far less frequent.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, textual critics will refer first to the standard canons of textual criticism, and only if those standard canons, the unintentional changes, can't solve the issue, only then will they turn to intentional alteration as a possible motivation for the scribal change. Now, what Ehrman does is he says, we're just going to jump right to the intentional. He doesn't even consider whether the standard canons of textual criticism, the unintentional scribal errors, can account for these changes. He just jumps straight into intentional, theologically motivated changes and accounts
when
for
he was,
Go ahead.
When he was on the show Unbelievable once debating Peter Williams, another textual critic, Peter Williams said, you know, Bart Ehrman's problem is he always goes with intelligent design instead of chance.
Mm, yeah, that's a good way to put it, sure.
Also,
that is kind of what we're getting at.
And also, I'm guessing the book that you're talking about is called Christian Origins and Hellenistic Judaism, right?
Oh, well, that's an edited volume. That's actually been out. That came out earlier this year. I think the date on it is 2013, although they had it at SBL last year. So, but I think the publication date is 2013 on that. But that's an edited volume, part of a three-volume set I worked on, called Early Christianity in its Hellenistic Context. That book is it's actually a different book. That book's with Brill. The book I'm referring to is a book that will come out later. It's called A Handbook to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. So it's a different project. But I appreciate the plug for the edited volume as well on Christian Origins and Hellenistic Judaism.
Well, whenever that book comes out, you and Dr. Porter are both welcome to come on here and talk about it. We'd be glad to plug it again.
All right. Well, that sounds great, Nick. I appreciate the invitation.
Okay. We're going to take another break. Yeah. I'll let you get back to what you were saying in a bit. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back to discuss more questions with Dr. Pitts.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Andrew Pitts, and I'd like to remind you all that, yes, donations are important. That is what keeps us going here. And if you want to donate to Deeper Waters personally, you can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. There's a donate button. You can donate to the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers. And you can even make donations to us through Risen Jesus via Ministry Mike Kona. And if you're tuning in here next week, we're going to have another good scholarly discussion, someone I'm pretty sure Dr. Fitz will be familiar with. And that's going to be, hopefully, Dr. Jonathan Pennington to discuss his book, Reading the Gospels Wisely. I found that to be a very eye-opening book, and I hope you'll be here next week to discuss that. So, now what were you going to be saying, Dr. Fitz?
I'm sorry, Nick, you're breaking up just a little. What was the question?
Okay. Let me repeat again what I was saying for everyone else. I just realized a mistake I made. I had said about donations that you can make donations to us through deeperwaters.wordpress.com if anyone wants to, and through Ratio Christi Issues and Answers, and even through Risen Jesus, the Ministry of Micah Kona. Just save that for us. And next week, our guest is going to be someone who I'm pretty sure you might recognize, Dr. Pitts, but he's going to be the author of Reading the Gospels Wisely. That's Jonathan Pennington, will be my guest, hopefully, next week on the Deeper Waters podcast. I've emailed him today already, just remind him, hey, you're due up next week, so let's hope that this week we will have him. So, now, what were you saying, Dr. Pitts?
Oh, yeah, I mean, we were just following up on the issue of Bart Ehrman and kind of this fallacy. What we do in the textual criticism book is we just kind of walk through each of Ehrman's examples in misquoting Jesus and show how the standard canons of textual criticism, just unintentional scribal error, easily account for these so-called intentional changes. And if, as Ehrman readily admits in his corruption of Orthodox Christianity, if, as he admits, these theologically motivated changes were rare in Christianity, by that principle, we should always prefer the more common, more pervasive tendency of unintentional scribal change. And so by Ehrman's own logic, we show that in each of the cases where he says the text is so-called corrupted, these are variations that are not outside of the domain of unintentional scribal alteration. So, that book, hopefully, we're trying to test it out right now among a group of seminary students and just kind of making sure it's at the right level, and then it should be released, hopefully, early next year.
Yeah, I've been looking on Amazon just now. I couldn't find it yet, so it's not on there yet. If anyone's looking, as far as I know, it's not on there yet. But we would definitely be pleased to have both of you come back. You'd come back.
Yeah, it'd be great. Some great PR. That would be great. Yeah, get the word out about it a little. It's not on Amazon.
Yeah.
We're waiting to give it to our publisher until we have a real high level of confidence that it's going to be really useful to seminary students. I mean, a little bit of the history behind that book is, as we were looking at books on textual criticism, there's something of a gap. You know, we have Greenlee, which is, must not be more than 120 pages. It's small, and I've used that in my intermediate Greek courses that I've taught in the past. But it's a small book, and we have that, and then we have the book you referred to earlier, you know, the Metzger and now Ehrman's updated it, the text of the New Testament. And so we have that, which is a highly technical book, and that's the one I use for my introduction to the New Testament class in seminary. And so we found something of a large gap within texts on textual criticism, textbooks that kind of provide an intro to the issues. And so we wanted to write kind of a mid-range book. I found the Ehrman and Metzger book to be at a quite high level for your intro seminary student. A lot of seminary students are coming out of, you know, a bachelor degree in business or, you know, a pre-med degree, and they feel called into ministry, or now they want to pursue maybe an academic career in biblical studies. And so a lot of times the average seminary student does not have the adequate background to understand or to approach more advanced textual books. Another example, D.C. Parker, he just came out with a really fine intro level book to text criticism, but it's probably more appropriate at a higher level of graduate study than introduction to the New Testament or intermediate Greek. Well, we have such a diverse range of students. Some students even potentially taking these courses for personal enrichment, so they can know the scriptures in the original language and have a more adequate hermeneutic as they approach the text. And so that's certainly the kind of student that I've seen in our MDiv level classes. And of course, you always have to be more advanced students as well, but we wanted something that was going to be really versatile and real mid-range, and we don't have that kind of textbook right now. So our text critical book tries to incorporate stuff as basic as how to use the Nestle-Aland text critical apparatus and the differences between the UBS and the Nestle-Aland textual notes or the text critical apparatuses in those respective editions of the Greek New Testament. So stuff as basic as that to patriology, how do we move from a papyrus into our printed editions of the Greek New Testament, to issues such as the history of English translations and kind of how we arrive at our translated versions of the New Testament. And so we try and cover a broad, historical suite of textual studies and history of the New Testament text in that book that provides an intermediate level textbook that we believe fills a gap in modern pedagogical level works for textual criticism.
It seems with works like Forge of Ermenfet, what's going on more than anything else is what we've seen happen with books like The Da Vinci Code and the New Atheist books and most recently Risa Aslan's Zelda, is that controversy sells, and that if you write something that goes against Christianity, that's really controversial and written for the layman, it'll sell like hotcakes. But unfortunately, most people only hear the side of, say, Ehrman or someone else in that regards, and they don't really bother to check the other side. It's the old saying that air can get halfway around the world before the truth even straps its boots on.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, people love that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Highly critical, highly skeptical. Yeah, they have a desire to feed that.
It's kind of like when Karen King, I think it was, came out last year, with this manuscript saying that Jesus was married, and that got so much media attention, but when it was discovered that that wasn't really accurate, that didn't get as much media attention.
Oh, yeah? Oh, no, Nick, yeah, you're quite right about that. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it's just... Yeah, people. What fun is it for people to hear? Oh, the Bible's been right all along. people, especially for non-believers, they, that's not what they're interested in hearing necessarily. So, I think what you notice is quite right.
Since we're talking about forgeries, I think one other book that we definitely need to discuss in the Bible is one you've mentioned earlier, and that's Second Peter. Because I think of all the books that are thought to be forgeries, I think Second Peter is most likely thought to be a forgery than any other book, as far as I know. Would you say that's correct?
That is, yes. That's certainly, as I said before, even more than the pastorals. Also, First Peter is often thought. Second Peter as well, sure.
Yeah. And the thing is, with Peter, we have even less information that we could use, because with Paul, we've got at least 7 letters that are universally accepted we can compare. With Peter, we don't really have much writing style that we can compare. So What's the answer for us on the Petrine epistles?
Yeah, interesting you should ask. I have a commentary as well. I just finished my dissertation, and so my next project is to get this Petrine commentary out there. And it's a linguistic commentary, and so I've actually thought quite extensively about issues of authorship and style and styleship in the Petrine corpus. And I think you make a great point, Nick. I think if corpus studies in the Pauline corpus are, mm-hmm. at least with respect to the issue of authorship attribution, if those are problematic due to sample corpus size, we don't have a big enough sample to provide a data set that says, okay, this is the Pauline authorship fingerprint. We don't have enough text to do that. If that's problematic for seven letters, how much more problematic is it for two? And so if First Peter is the standard, then all we have is five chapters of text, right? And we know, you raised the issue of amanuensis, and we have that in the Petrine corpus as well with Silvanus.
We should clarify for the audience that amanuensis is another way of saying secretary.
Exactly. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a relevant concern. We obviously have the problem of corpus size. The main kind of distinction with First and Second Peter, First Peter is often questioned on the basis of its Greek. And so a lot of scholars insist that the Greek of First Peter is too elevated to be authored by an illiterate person. Now, if you look at the word for illiterate, that's based in Acts 4. It's Acts 4, the audience calls Peter. They say, how can these men who are illiterate, understand such deep things and kind of speak at the same level and with the same authority as the learned wisdom teachers in the first century? But that word illiterate is actually a misnomer in the translation. It means that those who are not professionally trained in wisdom schools of the Jewish teachers. And so to say that Peter was illiterate was to say that he was not a religious professional. That's all that is to say. And so that in no way entails that Peter was unable to read or write. So that's the first consideration dealing with authorship in the Petrine corpus and whether the historical Peter was involved. A second concern is, could this peasant Jew have learned the high degrees of, it's not literate Greek, it's still non-literary Greek, but it's decent Greek. It's not literary Greek as some people claim. So we don't really have a pure instance of literary Greek. The closest thing that comes to literary Greek in the New Testament is Luke, Acts, and potentially Hebrews, and maybe after that First Peter. But none of those are a pure form of literary Greek. None of them use attistic vocabulary. They're guilty of non-Attic kind of slurs. John Lee, in a volume that Stan Porter and I edited called The Language of the New Testament, he goes through the New Testament documents and shows that they are always committing the fallacies that the Attic grammarians, mention in their grammars. So we don't have any formal literary Greek. We have mostly non-literary Greek and stuff that tends to move more toward the literary side of the spectrum that are not fully literary and certainly not attistic. So, Attic Greek, which is kind of a higher, more formalized expression of Greek. So it's wrong to think that Peter is in some way this highly, literary document. Some of the better Greek in the New Testament, but that's about all we can say. Could a... You need to move to a commercial break?
Yeah, we're going to take our last break right quick, and we'll let you finish that part when we get back, okay?
Sure. Thank you, Nick.
Okay, we'll be back after this break, and we'll be wrapping things up when we come back with Dr. Andrew Pitts on forgeries.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI.
And you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back with Dr. Andrew Pitts. I'm Nick Peters. We are discussing the topic of forgeries. And remember, everyone, next week my guest will be Jonathan Pennington, and we'll be discussing reading the Gospels wisely. Now, what were you going to be saying about the Petrine Corpus?
Sure. Yeah, the point there is, that a lot of people wonder about is whether a Jew, a peasant Jew like Peter, a fisherman, could be capable of the high literary Greek we find in the letter there, especially if he was illiterate, as Acts 4 tells us. Mm-hmm. I don't think illiterate there means he couldn't write or read, just he's untrained. And that Greek word is testified in the papyrus as a non-professional. Mm-hmm. So that's the point of consideration to be taken seriously. So could he have been capable of picking up and adapting? I think so. We have a historical evidence, solid historical evidence of Peter spending a great deal of time in Rome. Papias tells us that Mark's gospel was the product of Mark listening to Peter's speeches in Rome. And so Peter's spending a large amount of his time in Rome, and Mike writes this later, a little later in life, it's easily conceivable that while in Rome he could have picked up and acclimated to the level of Greek we find, which is not as elevated as many people often assume that we find in the letter of 1 Peter. A third consideration. So we have Acts 4 is unprofessionals, not literally illiterate. Second, Peter spent a great deal of time, many, many years in Rome before writing this letter. And then third, we have the issue of Salvanus, who is the scribe that assisted Peter in writing the letter to 1 Peter. So that third issue actually relates to the second document in Peter's name. And so here we don't seem to have mention of Salvanus and the clothing. And so this, I think, is an important distinction that marks off 2 Peter from 1 Peter, is the lack of an intervention of a scribe, apparently. So I think with that, as well as what you mentioned with respect to the corpus size and these other considerations in 1 Peter, I think we can uphold Petrine authorship for both 1 Peter, which is often questioned, and even 2 Peter. I see no reason to doubt that, personally.
Something else that can be kept in mind is, it's my understanding that letter writing in the ancient world wasn't really a private practice, that you would often be writing a letter in a room. We often have a picture of a scribe sitting at a desk, but the desk didn't really exist back then. You'd be writing a letter in a room. People would be coming in and out, and they'd hear what you were writing, because you'd probably be speaking it out while you were writing, and they'd offer their own suggestions of things that you could say as well.
Oh, yeah. That what you're referring to is the scriptorium, right? These public kind of composition houses. These were often a place where letters were copied, or documents were copied and sent out. But yeah, you would also have some compositions sent in a scriptorium. And there was some variation. I think certainly, Paul's letters from prison probably were written, some of them at least, in somewhat of a more private setting. But you're right, you have even Paul mentioning co-authors as well. Not only secretaries, but co-authors. For example, Philippians is not only written by Paul, but it says Paul and Timothy. I mean, what does that mean? It could be that Timothy was the carrier of that letter, but he may have contributed and, been kind of present, as you say, there with Paul writing this, so that it was a much more collaborative process. Yeah, they didn't have laptops and kind of these kind of private computers, or even, a few centuries back, access to lots of private writing material. A lot of times, if they wanted access to these materials, they would need to go to a scriptorium, a place that would would have high wrists that they could use and pins. You know, it was cumbersome to lug around on travel, in their travels. I did an article called Paul, His Bible and the Scriptures of Israel. And that article looked at, you know, the kinds of materials Paul would have had access to. And, you know, it would have been quite a task for Paul to carry around these big old scrolls of papyrus, you know. So, yeah, you're right, Nick. Some of this could have been, you know, done in a public setting. I don't think all of it was, but certainly part of it could have been. And that's a good consideration to bring in mind. I think the main thing kind of that we're coming to, Nick, is that there's so many complexities involved in the ancient context of letter writing.
Yeah.
Everything from methodological considerations of corpus size to practical considerations where computer testing has actually been shown to be fallacious. When we know one author was involved, even though we have stylistic differences, to theological considerations where vastly different historical situations are being addressed with theology instead of systematic theology being written. We also have these historical circumstances that you're mentioning, from the scale of private to public settings for the composition of letters, to the implementation of amanuensis or a secretary, to even co-authors, such as Timothy, so that with these numerous complexities, it really is difficult to lean so heavily on the internal evidence and say, we've got some differences here between the letters. Well, yeah, that's what we'd expect to find with this many moving variables that we discover. Another thing we haven't really emphasized is the vast amount of chronology that transpires. You know, I alluded to it earlier, but I think it's an important consideration. You know, we have a nearly 20-year span for the composition of the letters written in Paul's name. And not surprisingly, the letters group stylistically according to the chronological continuum. So the early letters group together. Paul, in his early years, writes Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians. Those group together stylistically. The prison letters, which were all written around the same time, Ephesians, Colossians, Philippians and Philemon. Yeah, Philippians and Philemon. Those were all written around the same time in the same historical situation, and not surprisingly, they grouped together. The first, the Thessalonian correspondence, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, written around the same time, I mean, within weeks of each other, most scholars believe, and not surprisingly, grouped together. And then finally, the pastorals, which were written probably on Paul's, what most scholars posit as a second Roman imprisonment toward the end of Paul's life. Again, if that's the context of pastoral letters, those are written around the same time, similar kinds of people, in a parallel historical circumstance, and so they tend to group together. And so chronologically, we have a grouping as well that is exactly what we'd expect to find. Now, you see shifts, but these shifts accord with the chronology. So I think that's a further consideration. All that to say is these numerous complexities make it very difficult to make convincing internal arguments based on style against Pauline authorship that are, you know, compelling enough to overturn the vast array of external evidence we have that is almost uncontested in the ancient world that Paul wrote these documents. And so I just think the case for Pauline authorship of the 13 letters in his name in the New Testament is as strong a position as any that we could find in New Testament scholarship.
I often have the opinion that if scholars treated the New Testament the way they do most any other ancient text, there'd be a whole lot more Christians out there. But the New Testament is given a different standard in every single area, that the evidence we have for authorship of some works and reliability of those works is far better than it is for other ancient manuscripts. Those other ancient manuscripts are given the benefit of the doubt. The Bible is treated differently.
You're right, Nick. I think that's a really astute observation. You know, it's quite a different standard that's being applied. Paul Meyer, who I'm sure you are familiar with, he is an ancient historian who also writes on you know, issues of early Christianity, and he you know, is shocked by the blatant inconsistency between how ancient texts from the world of classical Greece and Rome are treated in comparison. They're just given the benefit of the doubt, most classical
yep.
texts.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the New Testament is not typically given the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
The New Testament is the only ancient document that we are treating as guilty until proven innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with other documents, they're innocent until proven guilty, right? And so
mm-hmm.
It really is a different standard, interestingly. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, there's obviously the ideology that attaches to these texts and the religious history and the communities of faith that they are so important to. And I think that's one set of concerns. I mean, also, you look at kind of the industry that, especially in the Enlightenment period and, you know, with the rise of German higher criticism, there's this kind of pressure to be innovative and to be new. And a lot of these theories generate as either doctoral dissertations or kind of novel ideas about the text that are really the result of pressure, academic mm-hmm. pressure to have these insights to continue to push forward the discipline and be on the cutting edge. I think a lot of times they're just not as convincing as they are new. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's a new idea, but maybe not as convincing as many people believe.
It's along the lines that I think it was Schweitzer who said that scholars who write about this work or Jesus, strangely enough, come out with a Jesus who thinks just like they do, that when existentialism was popular, lo and behold, here come existentialist Jesuses out there, and that usually our worldview, such as today, our skepticism against miracles, which was addressed a couple weeks ago when we had Craig Keener on, that our skepticism against the miracles then means where we have to approach the Gospels differently instead of saying, maybe the Gospels are evidence that our skepticism of miracles is wrong, that our worldview is interpreting the text instead of the text informing our worldview.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is certainly a... And that's kind of that first point I mentioned. You know, there's, on the one hand, this academic pressure for new ideas, and kind of the way that has moved in biblical studies has tended to be toward greater and greater skepticism toward the biblical text. And then on the other hand, you have, yes, the religious ideologies. So
mm-hmm.
Everybody is approaching this with an ideology. There is no
yep.
kind of neutral view. And so, you know, Helmut Kester, you know, at Harvard, a biblical scholar at Harvard, you know, fairly critical of religious ideas as a whole, he's going to approach his New Testament scholarship from the perspective of that ideology. And
mm-hmm.
he's not going to be able to get outside of that. And I don't claim a neutral standpoint either. I mean, as a Christian,
yes.
I must approach the biblical text from that distinct vantage point. And so, yeah, with more of, and it's an interesting phenomenon. Like someone like Bart Ehrman, I mean, what happens there? You know, we kind of have someone who starts out and, you know, even what he describes as fundamentalist Bible circles. And he
mm-hmm.
sees that the kind of fundamentalistic paradigm is faulty, and then there's kind of a radical shift and in the opposite direction. And so
mm-hmm.
I think that does happen a lot of times too. And
yeah.
you know, not necessarily with Bart Ehrman, but you know, maybe someone goes into scholarship kind of with a fairly maybe a kind of naive understanding of the Bible, and then that's kind of shattered, and they, you know, they feel a little bit misled, I guess. But that's certainly
mm-hmm.
the case with Ehrman. He felt misled.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's indicative of several others' experience, and so there's kind of a, maybe even a more critical stance that's taken toward the biblical text as a result, and maybe a desire to expose a wider audience to some of these ideas.
We've got a little under 6 minutes left. Dr. Pitts, my audience wants to get in touch if you find out more about you and such. Where do they go?
Oh, good question. Right, I mean, they could add me on Facebook if they'd like. Andrew W. Pitts, I believe, is my name on Facebook.
P-I-T-T-S.
Andrew Pitts, yeah. You know, feel free to add me there. But as you said earlier, I'm just getting started here, so no websites or anything like that at this point in my very young scholarly career. Yeah. But feel free if they want to connect. They can also email me if they have questions, Andrew, and then my middle initial, which is W, my last initial, which is T, so andrewwp@gmail.com.
Okay. Now, what final message? We've got a little under 5 minutes left. What final message would you like to leave for the audience and how they can study questions of forgeries in the New Testament?
Yeah, and I just think, all academic critical theories aside, I think just intuitively, you know, we can come to the New Testament and know these documents, at least in the case of the Pauline corpus, they claim to be written by Paul. There's not significant documents or manuscripts or early fathers, there's not significant evidence to overturn that. Almost all of the arguments are based on some kind of internal consideration. That is to do with the language, the theology, the style. But intuitively, we all know that a letter to our grandma is going to look different than a letter to our employees, and still different than a letter to our wife. Our language is going to be expressed differently. Our style is going to change. A letter written when we were 20 is going to just have a different set of ideas and linguistic variables than a letter written when we were 40. So I think just at a very common sense, practical level, we can see the inconsistency and lack of intuitive convincingness of these arguments for forgery.
Okay. Well, we certainly hope we're going to be seeing you back on here again sometime. I think it'd be fascinating when your new book comes out. Yeah. And if you can bring Dr. Porter with you as well, that would be even better.
Okay. Well, we'll have to see what he says. But I'll keep you updated as that book progresses. We're hoping to see it out next year. So.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up here. I do want to thank everyone for tuning in. I hope this has been a very informative show for you. And I want to remind you again, yes, next week we're going to be talking with Dr. Jonathan Pennington about reading the Gospels wisely. So if you want to know the best way to read the Gospels, well, you need to be tuning in next week. And again, Dr. Pitts, my thanks for you for taking your time to be on the Deeper Waters podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Nick. It's been a real honor to be on the show.
Hey, thank you. And we'll be back next week with Dr. Pennington. Until then, see you next time.